impossible not to be romantic about sports this Monday.
Were you in tears? Adam Stanley was in tears, he said.
That's a little strong.
That's what I said. Have you ever cried as a result of a sporting event?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
But mine was golf, too, so I can't make fun of it.
Oh, see, that's... Yeah, you cried during Tiger. I cried...
2019,
I cried. Oh, my God. 2010, after we won the Olympic gold. I burst out in tears in the bar in happiness.
I can't say definitively that it hasn't happened, but nothing...
Yeah, but you're not that guy.
I think I could be. I'd like to be.
I'd like to be.
I'm not saying, yeah.
Crying over Rory McIlroy unless his family member is a little much.
I mean, maybe it's a little different for Adam Stanley because he has, like, he's talked to him, he's interacted with him.
No, that makes
it
worse.
Yeah, I wish you'd never told me that.
Yeah. That makes it way worse.
I am going to, the second we're done here, I'm texting Stanley, like, oh, you've been crying.
If he hadn't said it on the radio,
I would have been like, hey, man, don't tell people that.
Yeah, no, he said it. So that's why I feel like it's not something that was said in confidence. He said it.
I can't stand him, but...
I love him.
Like, watching that reaction...
Yeah.
No. That was the most human reaction I've ever seen
did
from
you guys
a media
watch his post-game?
I watched the entire press conference.
He was the most... It actually... Okay, I don't want to... I'm not trying to take a shot. I swear to God, Sammy, this isn't trolling you.
Oh, here we go.
I'm serious. This is not...
It seems like it's going to be a shot.
Usually... It's not a shot at you. Yeah. It's not a shot. I just know you're going to take this personal.
Yeah.
But... Rory McIlroy in that post game, the way that
in Butler Cabin, you mean?
Yeah, no, just his media availability. Okay. Yeah, his media availability.
That's what I watched too.
His media availability made me think about how, like, the time we've missed with him winning major championships, and how he's just such a different level of human being than Tiger Woods in terms of like relatability. Like Tiger Woods, what do you know about him? Someone posted this clip of him. Like getting sad about or being emotional about hugging his son after he won the last Masters. And it was like, yeah, it was a cool moment. It definitely was. But someone tweeted like, this is the most human we've ever seen Tiger. And I went, yeah, I kind of agree. We never see it. Rory's talking about his nerves and the ups and downs of it all. Like just he laid it all out there for you in a way where I was like, man, how can you not root for this guy?
Yeah, you can't.
I thought it would be a way worse shot than that, by the way. I'm like, I can handle that shot. I thought it was going to be something way worse than that.
Oh, it's just, I'm just saying that.
Like Rory has more personality than Tiger Woods.
But I think one of the major criticisms of golf is that a lot of these guys are just very robotic and very stale, and don't fall in love with the personality.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And Rory has been, I think, a bit more of a polarizing figure these past couple of years, especially it was not a great look that he was the champion against Liv, and then all of a sudden he was like, oh, they're just trying to get their money, and it's fine.
My second home in Dubai.
Hey, I love Dubai. It's a great place to go.
I like to race there.
Yeah, exactly. Like, that was a tough moment, man. That made me anti-Rory for a bit, but... Watching him yesterday at that podium talking about it and just the elation in the moment, I went, man, I like this guy. I love this. Like, we're watching the highlights of on our TV. It's impossible not to look at it.
So relatable because, my God, if he had just cruised the way it seemed like he was going to
do. No, this is the better way.
After he cleared Rays Creek on 12 and I texted you, I wouldn't relant. And you're like, oh, I know it was over. It was over. And I was like, nope, back nine. Let's see the tee shot on 10. But really, it was the tee shot on 12. And then to do what he did on 13 and 14. I mean, anyways, we don't have to go through every single shot.
No. I actually do want to go through just this a little bit. Like, because Friday he has the low round after the choking on Thursday, which was 15 and 17.
Mm. Yep.
He carries a four.
He's four under in the middle of the fairway on 15.
Yep. He's four under in the middle of the fairway on 15, like you just said. And he finishes the day even. And you are basically already writing him off. I had Gunning on my show on Friday to be like, I'm sorry that I texted you about Rory because he blew it. But this guy's blown it so many times that you thought one little step of adversity was going to completely derail this guy's tournament because that's what we've seen over and over and over again.
How about 20?
But that's it. So he comes out on Friday and he shoots the low.
Yeah.
He's incredible Friday. Just completely locked in, dialed in. And what is the major discussion point from everybody is, okay, well, now he's going to choke. This is even going to be worse. Now there's hope. Saturday, the first six holes are incredible.
Yeah.
He's unbelievable. He's dialed in. He's lights up.
I think it was probably the best six-hole stretch in the history of the tournament. I don't think anyone's ever made six straight threes.
He was five under after four, right?
Yeah.
And then he's got this makeable putt to go up four and just seemed to lose it.
Mm-hmm.
Finishes the day obviously he's got top position. And what's the narrative going around it? It's like, well, the rest of the field's not really there. It's him versus Bryson. And Sammy's texting me going, man, Bryson is a major champion, and this is the worst guy that he wants to have next to him. He would have much rather have had Corey Connors.
Well, that's the nicest guy in the world.
I mean, that point still true.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, he wants, like, the nice guy that doesn't say anything and just will just go away quietly.
I was going to say that. Listen, all due respect to Corey Connors, like, again, represented Canada very well at this tournament.
Great.
But his Sunday was the most predictable Sunday in the history of all Sundays.
I don't know if even I could have predicted him missing a 1 foot putt on the first hole.
Yeah, that was a little tough. But it was kind of funny.
Touched the hole?
No, he didn't.
But Sammy and I always joke about how they hate showing Corey Connors in the coverage. It's like, it doesn't matter, because every year when he's great, they'll give you like two shots, and he missed that putt. And Sammy just texts me right away. He's like, "And there goes all the
I said, get ready to learn drop from coverage, buddy."
It was over. The dream was completely dead. But okay, then Sunday, right? Double bogeys the first hole.
Yeah, that was over. Amazing. It's over.
That was amazing, even for him.
Yeah,
like in his choking way. It's like, I couldn't believe he doubled it.
No, it was crazy. And it was a great par for Bryson, too.
Yeah.
There were three two-stroke swings over the first four holes.
It really felt, you heard the USA chants, and Sammy had, again, warned me about this as the hardcore golfer, that, man, this is like, people love Bryson. They're going to be behind Bryson in this gallery. And I went, oh, my God. It's going to turn into a Bryson fest.
He was dapping people up on his way to the first tee. He let Rory go first so he could make his WWE entrance.
He's doing things where he's fist bumping everybody.
Yes.
And Rory,
big smile on his face while Rory looks like, oh my
catatonic,
God.
Catatonic, walking through the crowd, no fist bumps to anyone. And I'm like, oh my God. This is your Bryson birdies. All of a sudden, he's down a stroke.
Yeah. That was
after
crazy.
Two holes.
That's insane.
But then again, huge birdie on three, then again on four.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh my God. Then the massive recovery shot out of the woods on five.
One of the great shots. I would have said the greatest shot of his life until we get to 15, which I'm sure we'll get to.
The shot on seven where he clips the tree.
Oh, that's the one I'm talking about.
Seven is the one where, like, his caddy's like, please don't. And he's like, yeah, I will.
No, I'm going to.
And then he bulldozes
you as usual, Harry.
He tries to go over the tree. He goes through the middle of the tree. Yeah. He does what everybody, like every weekend golfer does, where it's like, 90% air. And he does it. Clips the tree, almost flies it in the hole on seven.
No, it was incredible. And in that moment, you kind of felt like, so this was the beauty of this tournament. There was so many times where you're like, it's over. He can't blow this. Because after seven, he goes 9-10, back-to-back birdies. Yeah. And now it's starting to feel like a complete runaway.
Birdie on 10. 10 like, was God.
Like, once he got the drive out of the way, and then to birdie
And he drops his club because he thinks he like heals it. And he's like, what? There's a little bit off the toe or whatever it was. Anyways.
No.
Continue.
Glorious.
11. Talk about 11.
Yeah.
11. He almost puts it in the drink with his second shot, trying to lay up. Like,
but doesn't. Survives the disaster.
But still makes five.
Sure. But even still, in that moment, Bryson has completely fallen apart. And you're looking at the field and you're trying to think, like, maybe Oberg is going to get hot. Mm-hmm. Like, that's the only hope in that moment was Oberg is starting to push. Scheffler just refuses. He's just not getting in the mix enough. But Oberg at that point, I think, is like three strokes back.
Yeah.
And you're going, okay, maybe. And then the creek on 13. Like, wait, you mentioned dry on 12.
12, and I thought for sure that he would air, like some guys have done, long, and then you end up in like the azaleas or whatever. That's no joke back there either, because you could chip it in the water from back there. But no, it's a perfect tee shot, makes three, and okay. 13, I know Amen Corner is technically the drive on 13. 13 was playing as like the 30s. Especially if you lay up the way he does, you can't make worse than five there. It's impossible to do.
To me, the choice to lay up, like to that decision from the start, where you're going to hit 3-wood or whatever, but that's completely going outside of his own comfort zone.
That actually felt like a lot of this tournament.
If you take a driver and you blast a driver, he's going to have what, 212, 215 in with an iron? Like, is it a 6-iron, 7-iron for him? Like, he usually went completely outside of his comfort zone.
And you just have to go left, right?
And he lays it up there. And I got to tell you, I'm like, I texted him a couple of times. I was like, I don't love him laying up. Like, just go for it, man. I know you're in the lead, but, like, you can hit those two shots in your sleep.
But that was it. It's like, this is the up and down roller coaster mental ride of this thing is just when he thinks it's safe, it's just not.
No.
Well, I mean, so that shot may have been the worst shot he's ever hit in his professional life. To put it,
I actually think the bogey putt on 14 was the one that I looked at as the worst of them all.
No, man, 80 yards with, like, he missed, like, it was like 20 yards right of where he was aiming because the whole thing funnels towards the hole from the left side. Yeah. And to leave it where he left it from 80 yards, like, if you're a pro and you're not within, like, 7 feet from 80 yards, that's a bad shot.
Well, yeah, that shots-wise, that one and 18 were the worst two.
Exactly, and they were both wedges. Yes,
but the putt then on 14, because you're like, oh, my God, this is happening, but he still has enough of a cushion where you're like, he's still not gonna. That's a bad hole, but he built up this lead for that moment, but he can survive that moment because it's gonna be fine. Meanwhile, Justin Rose is like, I'm getting hot.
Yeah.
And you're looking at Justin Rose saying, man, I wish this was anyone but Justin Rose.
Yeah. He's got a lot of pedigrees.
Sure.
He's a classic
two-time runner-up at the Masters.
Not my favorite guy.
Well, and also, it just felt like he didn't have enough space and that Rory would be able to, close out the back nine with a couple.
Yeah, because he just needs to go even par after 12 the rest of the way.
But then he misses again that putt on 14 that hung on the edge of the hole.
Yeah.
With, like, I kept thinking, okay, one little breeze.
Yeah.
And that's going to drop. Like, can you just go
around to the back?
Yeah.
I was sitting there. I just was not one of those ones that was going to drop in for him. Try to get this shadow over top of it.
Then the legacy shots on 15 and 17.
Yeah, I mean, the legacy shot on 15, but he misses that putt, too, for eagle. I mean, that was an incredible shot.
Yeah,
no question.
Was.
And it just gets him back tied for the lead, right?
Yeah. But then 17 again, you're basically debating which is the greatest shot. I still think it's 15.
Yeah.
But 17 was...
17, he had to have it.
Yeah.
And then you're like, okay, it's not over. An easy... part,
again,
but, like, if you get the drive out of the way on 18, you should be able to put it on the surface.
Bunker on 18.
That's crazy.
And then he makes...
I screamed out loud.
Then he makes we did look at the bunker.
No way! Yeah. It was my exact words.
I think I just had...
It was like, it was the wedge on 13 and 18 where you're like, what are you doing? This is... these shots are putrid. But then he recovers and he's got a putt.
Great sand shot.
Great sand shot. He's got a putt to win the Masters. It's like a putt that is...
Everyone knows what that putt does. It's the 18th green at Augusta National. There's no... It's not like the U.S. Open at Pinehurst where there's even like, I know it's short, but, like, there's a little more to it. It's like, no, that's the 18th hole at Augusta National. We know what that putt's about. And it never really scared the hole.
Sammy texts me and he goes, is he going to make this? I said, 100% he's going to make this putt. Miss. Yeah. Sam says he's missing. He called it. He's like, he's going
to
miss this putt.
That's what I said. I think I said the same thing to Sam.
I just there's no shot this goes in.
Yeah. Well, I will say that I was right.
Eventually.
Yeah, I thought.
I mean, he needed to lop off two more feet because in the playoff it was 4 feet.
Yeah, anyway, 18, it ends up being a tie after Justin Rose makes this beautiful putt.
Unbelievable. Justin Rose at least has that he did the childhood thing to get himself into the playoff. He knew he had to make that putt for birdie on 18, and he just absolutely nailed it.
Yep. And then the playoff hole, playoff round, Rory, another just gorgeous shot. With his approach, you're wondering, is he going to do the same thing? Rose has put the pressure on.
Yeah.
It's definitely a makeable putt for Rose.
Sure.
And Rory sticks it 4 feet from the pin, boom, knocks it down. Masters champion falls to his knees. The reaction that we mentioned. The guys and I were talking about this before. If you're a Canadian, the Four Nations is going to be the best thing in sports this year, right? Like, it just is. Unless the Leafs win a Stanley Cup and you're a Leaf fan, or you're a Canadian fan of a sports team and your team wins a Stanley Cup. Like, I get that. But this is going to go down as after Tiger, the second most memorable Masters for me ever. Like, this skyrockets past Sergio. This is such a memorable and incredible event. But I can't envision us having this in golf for a very long time. Like, we did the thing. We're the dog that caught the car.
Oh, it sucks.
Yeah, I mean, no.
He was the He said it. The first thing he said in his press conference, like, what are we going to talk about now?
Yeah. It's literally, it's, like, go down. True. Go down, like, the world golf rankings and is like, who needs it? Like, who's under the gun?
I have it, by the way.
You can't do Ludwig Oberg
because he's so young. Completely irrelevant in terms of actual caring narrative.
PGA Championship Grand Slam for Spieth.
No.
No. It's you're so right because there's nothing, and especially to compare it to what we went through for the last decade plus, and then beyond that with the 2011 for Rory, it's not a lot going on. Like, we can hope and pray that maybe Rory has a chance at the season Grand Slam now that this has been lifted from his shoulders, but no, teeing it up at Augusta, what, like Tiger coming back off the Achilles zillion years old?
I don't think Phil's getting a U.S. Open.
That was truly one of the greatest. I hate doing the framing of this. Like, I talked to Brandon about this in the pre-show meeting where I'm like, I hate how modernity, it's always, is this the greatest or is this the worst? This wasn't even the greatest Masters I've ever seen because we had Tiger.
Mm-hmm.
But that was one of the most exhilarating sporting events I've ever watched.
Yep.
That was...
Because it was like 6 hours long.
Yeah, it was 6 hours long and it's over. Oh my God, it's over. Oh my God. This roller coaster ride that he put himself through... And this is the thing, again, about, like, the human nature of Rory that makes me love the guy is you could tell he was feeling the pressure of this moment, and he was bearing it all in front of us as he ended up actually accomplishing the biggest goal in the sport and becoming, like, a Grand Slam champion.
Maybe choking doesn't exist because...
Oh, choking does exist.
But, like, maybe you just can't be a choker because he was such a choker. He choked so hard. And then to, like, be able to overcome the choking as many times as he did.
Yeah.
God, we don't have Xander anymore. We got no chokers left in golf, for sure.
Well, I kind of think that, so if I'm doing the storylines out of this that matter to me now, next year going to Augusta, Bryson is far more compelling next year.
Sure.
Because Bryson just has to have a decent day. Like, a decent day, and he wins the Masters.
Yeah, no, I think a lot of guys that thought they were out of it going into Sunday realized very quickly that they were back into it. And boy, they had a couple of shots.
Yeah, but nobody blew it like him. Like, he took all the pressure off Rory. If there's anybody that, like, Rory should be thanking outside of himself and his caddy, it's Bryson DeChambeau for him being like, okay, well, at least I'm not doing as bad as this guy throughout the entirety of this tournament.
Bryson... And to his credit, he stuck around. He did the interview after with Balionis, and he looked completely shell-shocked.
Dude, like, he was sweating.
Like, he had no idea what had just happened, and he had no idea what to expect and the pressures. And that's the thing. It's like, that's what makes this tournament so unbelievable, is that these guys who are seemingly unflappable, like, Bryson is holding the U.S. Open Championship as we speak. Like, he is a major champion as we speak, and... He was just completely lost on Sunday. Like, he had no idea what to do out there. Like, he just looked
powering
awful.
Every putt through the break.
Yeah, like, he couldn't, like, he just wasn't playing golf even close to his standard. And listen, there's a lot of stats about his iron play being brutal and the difference in the iron play between Rory and him. And, like, maybe that was going to be the way it was going to go because he was hitting a lot of longer putts and, like, kind of, you know, the dork stats said it was going to correct, and it kind of did.
Yeah.
But I think the Sunday at the Masters is just a completely different animal from anything else in the sport, and you saw it with him. And Rose is a guy that has a ton of experience, played there a lot, and he's a guy that knows how to handle it, and he comes up and he plays great. So Bryson is a huge loser out of that. Like, I was so excited for him. I wanted him to put the pressure on Rory.
Yep.
And Rory didn't even need the pressure to choke. Like, he choked four separate times in that, but... If he had have had any pressure,
more than four.
Like, you know, Bryson finishes at, I guess Rose got to 11, so maybe. But even if, you know, like you said, what did he finish at?
Seven. He finished T5.
If he gets it to 12, he wins.
Yeah,
it's
that's
like,
what I'm saying.
It was not a crazy day he needed.
After the second hole, Bryson's at 11.
Yeah. So it sucked because I was rooting for Bryson. I wanted him to steal it away from Rory one more time, and he just wasn't even close. He wasn't even in the conversation.
That would have been the only thing that could have made this even better if it was Bryson instead of Justin Rose that was staring him down.
Definitely. If those guys were actually going shot for shot.
Like a duel.
Yes. And that's what we thought we were getting.
Yeah. Three stroke swings in the first four holes of that thing, back and forth they were going.
I will say, though, and again, Rory did choke multiple times and kept leaving the door open for the field, but it didn't feel like Bryson was going to be the guy straight up after the fifth hole.
Yeah.
Like those back-to-back birdies that Rory threw up and then Bryson missing that one putt from like 4 feet out. I think that one was on four. Mm. It was like, oh, okay, this guy's not serious about this today.
And he never really, outside of the time he was leading by one that was after the second hole, it never really felt like he was in it at all.
So. Which is insane. The way that round started, and again, Bryson made a nice four on one to counter Rory's six, and that he was pumping up the crowd, that they have, we have the mic'd up of them at the range and Rory talking about, oh, I got to get you back for taking the U.S. Open away from me. It's like, you kind of did that to yourself. Like that we had the post game of them not talking the entire 18.
Didn't talk to me once all day.
Yeah.
Love that though. Would you talk to the guy? I was like, hell no.
I got to tell you, I was actually surprised Bryson
admitted that,
referenced it.
Yeah.
It's like, what do you know what was at stake for him?
Right. Like, do you expect him? That means to me that Rory wanted it more than Bryson did.
Yeah.
Like, Bryson, it meant way more to Rory than it did to Bryson. Yeah. Like, are you
crazy?
Go hit
your shot.
Yeah, buddy, get out of my face. Yeah.
But don't you think, like, in this sport, it's almost one of those try easier sports? Like, I did feel like the mentality that Bryson appeared to have was going to work better for him than Rory, again, putting everything on his shoulders the way he clearly did.
Yeah, but that's why this was so magical, too. This is why this mattered so much.
It makes sense.
You could see just him kind of trying to keep it light with all the snacks he was having. Rory was
snacking.
He was munching. He was eating. I don't know. I'm like, this guy's chowing down. He's had like multiple meals on the course here. His smoothies, chewing on stuff. I was like, okay, yeah, what's he got going on now? Like, what's the next snack that he's preparing? The fact that he was clearly wearing it and that it was so important to him is why it's important to us.
Yes, 100%. And it would have felt so different if he had just cruised. He would have been elated, obviously, and there would have been some level of emotion. But that, all the intensity and some of the crying that some of us felt watching that thing, like amplify it by a million.
You think Adam Stanley's watching highlights right now?
I mean, this is the reason that he has every media guy in his corner.
Yeah.
Every media guy adores Rory because they know when they go into that little tent at whatever golf tournament they're going to get, they're going to get a 15 to 20 minute soliloquy of him talking about every little emotion he's ever had in his life. And I think that's why he resonates so much with the media, too. Like, you go down, I mean, I follow so many golf people on Twitter, and it's just, oh, my God, I could puke those soliloquies guys are writing about him. It's like, oh, my God. Nance, when he was walking up the 18th before he shanked his wedge into the, he's like, on the greens at home in Northern Ireland. Blah, blah, blah.
God, they were laying it on thick,
bro.
I will say this. If I was Rory's, like, if I was his family or those.
Shut up! Have you never watched him play in these moments? It's like, stop saying this stuff.
If I was his family watching the television coverage as they were running through his career on 18 before it was all said and done, I'd have been like, why couldn't you wait 10 minutes?
Yeah, like, Lance is like, you got to be the first one. Hey, you can't just say, I know he's calling it, but like, hey, just be like, lots of work left to do for what he really wants to do here. And it's like, I could never, I think about, you know, last year after the Panthers won the finals and Paul Maurice talked about, he got asked about like what he would think if they had actually blown that. And he was just like, that's a world that I'll never want to think about.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What would Rory be doing today if he hadn't have won? And he's sitting there with 125, like, I'm telling both of you guys right now that there's not a lot of things in pro sports. It's like, oh, I could do that. I'm like, I'm confident I could step up in that exact moment and hit it somewhere on the circumference of this massive green that's right there. For a professional golfer, 125 wedge in your hand with a chance to win the Masters, he would might have quit. He would have maybe just gone to Dubai for good. Like, he maybe just been racing to Dubai for, like, period.
This is part of the reason why I'm actually really glad he won is so...
I was like, I hate him, and I was like, please, God, win this, man. Like, God, I can't watch this.
I would have walked off after the double on one, honestly. I would have been like, this isn't for me.
We're good here.
So this is... He had edged it far enough. You know, like, it was he had done
he edged
it. He edged everybody far enough, and it was like, yo, man, relax. Like, this is...
Let's finish.
That's just, exactly. And I didn't...
That was actually just at the golf media tent when that was happening.
That's what I'm saying. It was like, you couldn't have this story go into next year. Like, it just... This was it. Like, do you think... Do you think he ever would have won if he doesn't get this one? I don't think he does. I think that this one was like too haunting.
I don't know, man. I thought every shot, every horrible shot that he hit was too much to overcome. So I can't say that for sure because that.
Yeah, but it feels like Augusta, like, weirdly ended up also breaking Spieth.
Yeah, I mean, Spieth might have broken Spieth though.
Yeah, but didn't he win? Didn't he win the Open after the Masters?
Yes, he did.
Yeah. So he won a championship. He won the one against Kucher was after the Masters.
He was on Tiger's pace though.
Yeah, he was. And then
he's gone.
The meltdown happens, and then he's just never the same guy.
Yeah. No, I would have said for
Rory's
sure.
Rory's young enough though. That's the thing. He's
35. Like Justin Rose 31. Is 44. Yeah. And he's still competing, right? Like,
boy, Rosie, this got the red carpet.
Yeah.
Sergio, he takes a dive for Sergio, whatever year that was, where he hooks one into the woods.
2017, yeah.
Yeah, and then.
Because I was there.
And then, yesterday.
Buying hats hits
one on the green. Great. And then he's like, I'll just miss this putt for you, Rory. No worries. Yeah. I won't even sniff the hole of this putt that everyone's had a million times.
It honestly did feel like the field was selling for Rory at one point, where it was like, guys, every time
they
cut away.
I'll hug you, Rory. I'll hug you and embrace you. I'll cry with you. Get your caddy. Come on. That was his dream matchup in a playoff. That was the if he could pick anyone in the field.
Corey Connors would have been.
But this older guy that's like not really a thing, who's like, good. And it's like a good win over him.
Yeah.
But like, he's his best friend, the Ryder Cup buddies. He can hug him and cry on the green. Yeah. Like, it was the perfect scenario for Rory. And like,
still had to hit the shot.
He hit a great wedge, but it's almost like a microcosm for Rory's career with with the wedge play.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's been horrible for a lot of his career with the wedges. And it's like, that's because he bombs at 300 and then he doesn't, or 330, hasn't worked on the wedges as much. Hits two awful wedges. The wedge on 13 and the wedge on 18 are two of the worst shots. He's improved significantly over his career. Why he's gotten better, why he's gotten more wins, and he improved, hits one to 4 feet and knocks it in. I just, it's almost like a microcosm for his improvement with the short clubs. But
I gotta tell you too though, this makes him This is why it's obviously a huge win for golf, because everybody's talking about golf today. Yeah. And if Justin Rose wins, I guess if it's in the choke, everyone's talking about it. But
this is a better story though.
Yeah. But if I'm saying of course it's a better story. I'm just saying that
it has more staying power.
Yes, but this is way better than a scenario where, say, Scottie Scheffler goes back to back, and we're trying to do the Scheffler dominant match. Like, this was by far the number one way for it to happen, or the number one thing to happen, and the best way for it to possibly happen, where everyone was engaged and up and down and playing this entire game with him. But also, it's a win for golf because it actually makes, to me anyways, Rory far more compelling now moving forward.
Totally.
Like, you care about all his other majors, whereas before, seeing Rory win the Open would have been great. Seeing him win a U.S. Open would have been amazing. But now that he has actually completed the Grand Slam and it feels like legacy stacking, it's way more interesting to watch him at every other tournament.
For sure, it is interesting. I do, like, the schadenfreude in me does, like, I know, of course he wants to continue to build on his legacy and continue to rack up the majors, but I just know this level of relief that he felt will now, it'll permeate every major championship round he has going forward, even this year, right?
So, like, I asked Sam this question.
It's not going to be as pressure-packed, anything.
So he's going to win another one this year.
Clearly.
Yes. Like, I think the amount of weight that was off his shoulder, like that emotional response that you see from him on the green, the way he talks afterwards.
Yeah.
This is a fully changed man.
Yeah, but that's amazing.
Fully changed man.
Golf needs a guy like that, because the guy at the top, Scottie Scheffler, nobody cares about.
No, he's. I mean, listen, I love watching him play. I'm a golf sicko. He's one of my favorites, but he's not a compelling guy.
Nobody's drawn in by him. You're not texting someone.
He loves God and Whataburger. Like, he's not like the most compelling dude on earth.
If you texted me, like, hey, Scottie's leading. And I'm watching the Open, but I'm just saying, he's like, Scottie's leading at the Open with nine to play. I'm like, all
right. Casuals aren't turning on the TV for that.
Yeah, that's
if it's
what I'm
Rory's got a one-stroke lead in the back nine at the Open, the TVs are turning
on. TVs are turning on, and people want to see it now.
You're right.
So it's like
100%.
They've got their top dog from a narrative standpoint back again.
Yes.
We got to see, like, I watched everything yesterday, and I was going through it, but remembering
including the Leafs?
Yeah. I was watching close. I'm professional. I had a show to do. I definitely wasn't like, give me the broad strokes here. Yeah, I got it. All right, cool. Yeah. No, it's fine. I definitely, dude, at one point I really did catch myself where I had double screen masters. Like, is that? Yeah.
Just the same broadcast?
Well, no, because you're flicking.
I was flicking.
Then,
but I was so enthralled after 13 that I just, I gotta watch this twice. And then I went, oh, whoopsie. Whoopsie daisies. I spent like 8 minutes. Because Sam texted me, he's like, perfect time for the intermission. I went, yes. Like, yeah, no, for sure. I was watching. I saw it. I swear I saw it.
Morgan Riley, anyway, big 3 points.
I again,
he was great.
Yeah, he was really good. Yeah. I could tell you. What a game. What a game for him. No, I, like I said, this feels very much like the Monday after the first round of the tournament where I'm living on the high of something. Mm-hmm. And now I've got to come down from chasing the dragon. I'm like, okay, let's start the playoffs now because I need to feel the juice of this. I need to keep this feeling going.
No, I'm actually the opposite. I'm glad that we get a little lead time, like until the playoffs start this weekend and the Leafs on Sunday, maybe.
You're not excited about the RBC Heritage Open this weekend?
Yeah, no.
That's
that an elevated event?
Yeah, it's a big one.
Yeah, that's hilarious how they do that immediately.
Give the Canadian Open the elevated event. Like, come on. Anyways.
Yeah. No, I need more time to talk about Rory, right? And, like, I don't want anything else to supersede that for a bit. Like, I want... This is one of those golf stories where it's like, not, okay, you get your Monday to talk about it. This is a whole week thing, right? Yeah. Like, the way it happened, and, boy, I was going through... earlier today, like the greatest historical sports moments that I've ever had the pleasure of watching.
I'll remember this for the rest of my life.
Absolutely.
Yeah, like Tiger is a different
category. And I thought
I
would remember Sergio, and I know you were there. Like, and I do remember Sergio. Yeah. Like, it's definitely one of the most memorable ones, but I do remember in the moment of that one thinking like, oh my God, this is going to be one of the, and now it's like with Tiger and Rory happening afterwards, I'm like, what happened?
My greatest shame is rooting for Sergio at that
Master. Who wasn't rooting for Sergio?
Yeah, exactly, but it's my greatest shame. I can't believe I did. I saw his outfit on Thursday.
Yeah,
I'm like,
the Spanish colors.
Well, like, why did I do that? Like some of the live outfits, okay, that one, I'm like, you
I got no
idiot.
Shame rooting for Sergio. I like rooting for greats at that tournament. Like that's what it's about.
The very goods? Yeah.
It just, I mean, it's there, obviously, like, a little different because the Patriots obviously had the equity, but, like, 28-3, I think it's more in the vein of the Red Sox down 3-0 to the Yankees or Game 7, Cubs in Cleveland.
Which is so weird because he had the lead coming into Sunday.
Yeah, but that's what it is.
Yeah, but I agree with you.
Yeah.
It's like he upset everyone despite coming into Sunday with a 2-stroke lead.
The final, World Cup final, Messi. And against France is in that conversation as well.
Yeah,
Mbappe. Where it's like, this is in firmly in any of those conversations for me. Of the last, of my lifetime, this is one of the more memorable things I think I'll ever see.
And for golf, it has to be non-Tiger division, right? Because, you don't, listen, for people that are younger than us that didn't live through
But how many Tiger wins would you put ahead of this?
This is, I was going to say, 2019.
Yeah.
And that this one.
2019, but there was the Chris DeMarco.
Chris DeMarco year, whatever year that is. 2005?
And then, I mean, if we're just talking about Masters, but I mean, there's also Torrey Pines. Come on.
Yeah.
Like, let's for sure. Go nuts.
For sure. But. Yeah, I like.
Yeah, but still, you can stack this with the Tigers Masters.
Yeah, I mean, the first one there was no drama because he just lapped the field,
nothing's
like the
touching
pressure.
2019.
Nothing ever.
Yeah,
nothing's ever touching 2019.
I absorbed that one so differently too because I had to watch it on tape delay because I was going to it was an afternoon Jays game and I had to. They started the final round early because there was weather coming.
Yeah,
so I got totally messed up. And I blocked myself off. I didn't hear anything about it, and I went in totally fresh. But it was not the same.
My only thing about that.
Were you working at the Jays game?
No, I had my whole family.
Oh,
was like, cancel. Go tickets.
Cancel. Sell the tickets, brother.
This is just such an example of Ben being the cheapest guy ever. It's like he spends $10 on something. And he's like, I got to see it through.
Like, family, in-laws, and everything.
It would have been the easiest thing ever.
Go by them. Go themselves.
Hey, I'm going to take you guys to a sports bar, and we're going to watch Tiger Woods. Like, duh, easy. But you spent money, so you can tell us what it really is about. For me, the only thing that tainted the Tiger win in 2019 was that
everyone gagged.
No, I made a huge bet.
Oh,
with a buddy, like, cause my whole thing was they're Tiger Woods fans. One of my buddies, Steve, he was like, Tiger's definitely going to win in the next 3 years. And I was like, okay. So we made an even odds bet for $500 that he wouldn't win one.
What a horrible bet by him.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Horrific.
No, that's what I'm saying. I was like, I tried to make it more money. I was being like, you're a coward. $500.
That's a true Tiger Dog.
I know he was. And so me watching the gags by the field and then having to send Steve that money was painful. I hated it.
I had money on Molinari and Tiger in that final grip. Yeah, it was a great feeling.
Molinari was like Mr. Never Bogeys.
And he was never the same.
And then he, gone. What happened to him? He gone. Just literally is gone.
He'd won a major before that. Like he was the holding open championship at that time, open champion at that time.
And Brooks Koepka had a putt too that he could have gotten in the mix.
18,
yeah.
Everyone took a dive.
No, they did.
Good for them.
Hey, Tiger effect is real.
Yeah. It's too hard because we're in the immediacy of it. It just like, I know that, and that was big. Like Tiger to get one in 2019, the last one.
Tiger's is the one.
The way this happened though was more thrilling start to finish.
Well, I will remember, this is what I will say, is like for Tiger, God, it was really more just like the back nine, right?
Mm-hmm.
It was like 12 and like Amen Corners, like you're like
16.
And it wasn't, the Tiger was just steady. It was like, it wasn't anything he was doing. No. It's just everybody else was collapsing.
Yeah, that's what I mean. As this one was like Rory versus himself.
Yeah.
This was like literally the epitome of golf where it's like, it's you versus you.
Yeah.
And there's no one else out there, but
it's just you. It was, there was no field. There was no other memorable player. No. It was just Rory versus Rory, and Rory won.
It's like Ben trying to break 90 at Deerfield, just battling against himself.
That's exactly right.
All right. It was great. Anyways, I got more on this with Jason Sobel, Golf Analyst for SiriusXM later in the show today. Take a quick break, come back, and talk a little Jace. So it was a great day. Leafs get 1 point from clinching the Atlantic, Rory wins the Masters, and the Toronto Blue Jays come back to beat the Baltimore Orioles earlier in the day. I'll tell you one thing, Benny. I love when the Jays beat the Yankees, and I love when the Jays beat the Red Sox.
Mm-hmm.
But there is some spice with the Orioles now because it feels like they own the Jays. So to come back in that game and to win it and have Hoffman blow the kiss and that didn't mean a little more to you?
No, I mean that did because they came back. They came back from a 3-run deficit.
Like, yeah.
Yeah. Bylstraw, what an incredible clutch hit in the 10th inning number.
Yeah.
Because that's how they score on the bottom of this lineup. Yeah, I can't quite get there with the Orioles. I understand what you're talking about. And there is like recent animosity history, even going back to the Marcus Stroman, Jose Bautista stuff with Darren O'Day.
And also, that more recent than that, wasn't it Robbie Ray fighting with their manager, Brandon Hyde? Yeah.
Yeah.
It was.
Yeah.
It was,
I guess,
where he's like,
that.
Go pitch. Throw the ball. They're yelling at each other. Yeah, it's great.
Sure.
But it's not even that. It's just like the Orioles dominate them.
And of course, Ryan Mountcastle, like, is off to a horrible start this year. He's like hitting seventh. He's like, first home run of the year.
Yeah.
Obviously.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, there's. They are like,
and they took the shine from the Blue Jays.
That's it. They're the kind of the Spider-Man meme where it's like Blue Jays fans were laughing at Orioles fans because their rebuild lasted only 2 years, and look at these two teams played in the wild card game, and look how much further ahead the Blue Jays are than the Orioles. And it's like, oh, whoopsie.
Whoops.
I mean, but they've won the same number of playoff games since then.
Yeah,
zero.
So it means nothing extra to you.
I mean, all the divisional games do, especially.
I don't care about the race.
Yeah, that's okay. That's a good point.
Yeah,
three of the five teams it matters against until the Rays prove that they're any good and not playing in a minor league stadium, which won't be until maybe next season.
Yeah,
or maybe not in Tampa.
It's weird. Again, I like to flip around and watch a lot of baseball, and it's so strange to watch not just one team play in the joke ballpark, but two because there's the Sacramento team.
Yep.
That plays where it's like you can just hang out in the outfield and have a picnic. It's literally just the most minor league ballpark look of all time, and then the Rays won.
And that one they had time to figure out, right? They're like, we handpicked Sacramento, where Tampa's like, our stadium blew up. Like, there was a hurricane that went through, and they're like, scrambling. But
it is so weird that they're in Sacramento. It's like, why couldn't you just be in Oakland for an extra year and just
play? There's reasons.
Yeah, just why? What reason?
No, there's none. There's
like,
none.
Like, I get it if you're moving to Vegas to your new stadium, but to be in Sacramento.
Well, I think that's it, is that they didn't want, like, the sour fan base doing more of their protesty stuff where they, you know, yelled at the John Fisher to sell the team, which he absolutely should do.
Yeah, that stuff.
I think they prefer the ugly look of playing in a minor league ballpark than the fans actively rooting against
the parking
the owner.
Lot every game. Yeah, what a weird situation. Anyways, Bo, way more positive stories out of this game, just from the standpoint of like Bo really coming up in the clutch. Mm-hmm. Jeff Hoffman, two innings of just complete lights out, shutdown stuff. Second time he's done this now this season. I will say, yeah, let's limit those.
It's pretty. So there's one of two things are happening here. Either they were so impressed by their medical, which was so different than the Orioles and the Braves, and they're like, this guy is made of titanium. Don't you worry. We got this, okay? Yeah. Or it's like, okay, let's get as many innings out of the way as possible before the event, the inevitable happens, which is probably the case with most guys that throw upper 90s, that their elbow explodes again. Of course, as a guy who's already had TJ. But, yeah, it's not advisable necessarily to keep throwing him out there for six-out saves. The first one, I think, was different than yesterday. The first inning, he threw like five pitches.
Yeah, it was nothing. This one was a real two-inning appearance.
That was like Mariano Rivera in the playoffs type stuff, where it's like, yeah, we don't have anybody else we feel confident in.
I actually don't think it was a we don't feel confident situation. I think it was a Hoffman wanted revenge against the Orioles situation. And they wanted to give it to him. Yeah. I think that this was a human element thing.
And I don't want to get I don't want to do the thing just because the results are happening that this feels relevant, but he does feel like he just has that attitude, right? Yeah. It's hard not to say that that's related, but there's a ton of pressure on him signing the multi-year. He's never been a full-time closer in an entire season. Mm-hmm. He signs a multi-year big-money contract with an AL East team after failing two physicals. And that he wants all that smoke, that he's been in so many tight games against not chump opposition, mm-hmm. right? And that he's come through, man, and then the gesticulating afterwards and in all those big moments and the blowing of the kiss. It's really everything you want out of your closer.
I think it's amazing. For him to blow the kiss is like, I'm confident and I'm a jerk, and I want the closer to be a jerk.
Yeah, sure. The best of had that element of jerkitude and like they're all weird. Like Jordan Romano is weird, right? Yeah. Like, and when he was great, he was like, he's crazy. He's in the bullpen in like the second inning, walking back and forth. But I don't know. Did you ever think he was
he's not intimidating.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hoffman's
just
intimidating.
Like, from a stature standpoint alone, right? Yep. Like, different dudes.
No, Hoffman has it where it's like, if Jeff Hoffman walks in the room, you're like, who is that guy?
Yeah, he's the guy that throws upper 90s and is like a pitch away from all that ending.
Okay, so again, it was a good win, like a very good win. Very, very nice win. And good for David Schneider, who got off the Schneid.
Yeah.
Because I really feel like, and yeah, Nathan Lucas, you made a great play in the field and came out. But he makes a huge base running error after getting lifted for Anthony Santander. And I need to ask you if you have a theory. I have one as to how this continues to be an issue with this baseball team. Because they almost had two, by the way. Like Ernie Clement almost got picked off, and I actually think he did get picked off at first base.
It was one of those where it's like stands. And
yeah, stands. But I think if they called it on the field out,
I agree.
It probably was the correct call.
Yeah, it's hard to like take the specific incident and relate it to like an overarching theory about this, but like in that incident, I do get it, where it's like a strike and the guy, you know, he's going to bunt, but he pulls the back bat and you're trying to get the jump on it, especially when a bunt is about to happen. But it's hard not to, and I know the manager doesn't do that. John Schneider wants this to be cleaned up every single year that it's been an issue, which is like every single year he's been the manager of this baseball team.
Yeah.
He wants it to be cleaned up, and no doubt there's an emphasis put on it in spring training, but the buck has to stop with your manager, and have we ever seen any actual disciplinary action enacted on any of the players that have been the culprits here? And I know some of it are your star players, the most notable incident.
Yeah, but that's how you do it.
Yeah, of course.
So it's not even a theory. It's like they clearly don't have enough internal accountability with this issue. Mm-hmm. That it isn't treated with the seriousness that it needs to be treated with, which is you hold your best players accountable for it. And this is always what it's going to be. This is any organization, right? You can't scapegoat Nathan Lucas, right? Mm-hmm. You can't have him be the, oh, hey, or you can't scratch David Kampf mm-hmm. after a bad game.
Yeah.
It has to be a star. Mm-hmm. You've got to show that no one is above the law, and then it trickles down to the rest of the group. Because if they say, okay, it's the standard for Vladimir Guerrero Jr., who just signed $500 million,
yeah.
then it can be the standard for everybody else.
Yeah, and base running is one of those things where you can do it. Like, physical errors, there's no point in punishing yeah. somebody for making yeah. errors. Like, stupid plays in the field, yeah. I suppose. But, yeah, base running, and it's not... Like the
yeah,
worst.
Like Jose Ramirez right now is off to this horrible start from an error standpoint. Like yeah. he cannot pick it at third the way that we're accustomed to. What, the Cleveland's going to bench him?
Yeah, bad boy for not yeah. catching the ball. He's yeah. trying to catch the yeah. ball.
I don't know. Sometimes there's been a couple where I'm like, are you trying to catch the ball?
Like the most egregious example is obviously Vlad getting picked off second base with the yeah. best hitter on the team at the plate.
Yeah.
And you're representing the tying run. But yeah, you're not going to like bench him in a playoff game after, well, partly because there were no games after that. But yeah, there have been instances during the regular season where Vlad in particular has been the guy that's been making the mistakes. Mm-hmm. And yeah, would it be the worst thing in the world even to just like not start him in a game? Even if you don't mention it as the reason, we know that there's like a bunch of top secret, super underground
yeah, just
disciplinary actions that yeah. have happened. Teoscar Hernandez, when he was a Blue Jay, George Springer, there were some moments where the organization didn't feel too pleased with the way those guys were mm-hmm. acting or reacting.
Yeah.
And nobody said, hey, these guys aren't playing today because they've been bad boys and we were trying to send a message. But those yeah. guys have had messages sent for attitude yeah, situations.
I don't think that John Schneider is the type that's going to sewer a guy in the media.
No.
I don't think he has done it yet.
I don't know if you can honestly even be that manager in pro sports, honestly, in 2025. But yeah, the idea of actually, hey, oh, it's kind of curious that guy's not playing today.
I'm just saying it doesn't seem to be his style in general.
Like, sure.
He's generally not a uber frustrated, just shoots from the hip kind of guy.
Mm-hmm.
Even in the worst of losses,
yeah.
he's not an unload and get pissed off dude.
No, he's not. And sometimes I feel like to his detriment where it's like, yeah, yeah, especially last season where it's like, just show us that you're as frustrated as we are. Mm-hmm. We know like intellectually you are, but there's a catharsis that the fan base gets from seeing you
yeah.
manifest what we all feel. But yeah, would it, I mean, it couldn't be worse. Like the base running couldn't be worse if he tried that. Why not try it? That's the thing that hasn't been tried.
Yeah. Okay. This gets a little bit more complicated if the left wrist discomfort for George Springer evolves into something worse.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we've learned that Santander should just be the DH and no more outfield for him after you just fall down. You're just trying to make a play and you just fall down.
Yeah, that's tough.
It's over.
That I on this team, there is no reason. Yeah, there's
too many guys that can play the outfield above average to have him out there doing this. Like, I don't care about his feelings. I don't care about the money that he's making.
Yeah.
Get him out. I don't want to see it anymore.
Yeah, well, and we know that, especially at Rogers Center, he's fine to be the DH and not be going to work on the turf there. But clearly, there's not, like, such an, like, a... You don't have to force Will Wagner because, like, where is he going to play if he's not DHing? Like, that's yeah. fine. How about not play? How about you don't play?
I'm not sure Will Wagner at this point right now needs to be an everyday guy.
No,
yeah.
he doesn't. I think, like, you have too many Will Wagners. Like,
yeah.
him and Alan Roden kind of, like, doing yeah. the Spider-Man meme. And
yeah, they are.
And that's fine. You can be major leaguers, and maybe you can have a long career.
They're when a little puppy sees themselves in a mirror.
Yeah. Yeah, like there is something to be said for like a league average OPS and the ability sure. to get on base and work a count.
Better than below average OPS.
Yeah, I would say that you would like to have some threat of an extra base hit, if yeah. not a home run. Which,
yeah.
if you're gonna be an unknown or league average guy, I'd rather have Addison Barger give it a whirl at that position. But yeah, no, like not Will Wagner as the DH. That's a criticism to the roster yes. management if yes. that's happening routinely for this team.
Yeah, so you can watch the Vladdy newser today at 1 p.m. on an extended edition of Blair and Barker. You can watch it on Sportsnet, Sportsnet Plus. You can listen on Sportsnet 59 of the Fan. This is my last thing. I want to do this quickly. I have felt the perception change with Vladdy this weekend from signing the money. Like, the expectation for me has changed. And I know he comes up with a big mm-hmm. base hit that drives in a run. And I think that overall he's been fine. But you know that this is the longest stretch in his career to open a season without a home run?
That tracks. It's a long time.
Yeah.
We've been playing now 16 games.
So he grounded into that double play. Mm-hmm. And he's kind of yucking it up at first base. And I know that's Vladdy. I know he's just a happy guy. And how could you not be? You're making $500 million to play baseball. Mm-hmm. But normally I don't care about that stuff. And this was the first time I saw those. I know you don't care about this because you're just, you know, it's a long season guy. I hated it. And I felt it. I felt the weight of that in this series. The perception is changing for me. I will tell you. It's not that a perception is changing in terms of, like, he's not worth the money. Mm-hmm. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that my expectation of him, when I'm talking about, like, the base running mistakes and the leadership component, mm-hmm. that when you get to $500 million, I kind of want a little bit of that, too.
Yeah, I could maybe go further down that path with you if they weren't 9-7. The record is everything, right? If this was, if they were 7-9 even yeah. right now, and even though he's hitting .302 with a .365 slug, yeah. I was interested to see what Juan Soto's done to start the season. He only has one home run, right? Yeah. Like so it's been a slow power start for yeah. Soto as well, playing yeah. in the cold in the Northeast and yeah. in Queens. But the record is everything, right? Yeah. Like if they were 7-9, Vladimir Guerrero Jr. going through his worst power stretch to start a season, and he's being introduced after signing a $500 million 14-year extension. Yeah, it'd be a totally different deal as opposed to a guy who had two hits and a big 7-6 comeback victory over the Orioles to put the Blue Jays back into first place in the American League East is a different story altogether.
I'm not, again, this isn't me trying to make a judgment on the contract. Mm-hmm. That's foolish.
Yeah.
If you made up your mind on the contract extension during the summertime, which I did, which was extend him at this kind of dollar figure.
Yeah.
I actually don't know if there's really anything that can happen this season outside of like an abject disaster year where the OPS is again somewhere like 780. Mm. That would be pretty disastrous. 770, 780 OPS for Vladdy this year. You're like, man, that's just from the standpoint of if you would have played it out, you're going, he's not even getting close to $500 million if that kind of a year happens. But I'm not going to change my mind on that. All I'm saying is that the perception of the pressure that is on him, to me, is now higher with the money.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
Even more so than Anthony Santander, who has no equity within the fan base. And Santander came with, like, man, if Nathan Lucas doesn't forget how to run the bases, that was a pretty clutch double for Santander in the ninth inning.
Yeah, right? Hit a home run and got a clutch double. So it's like he's trending in the right direction. Anyways, subscribe to this podcast. We're going to take a quick break, get back into the Rory stuff with Jason Sobel. Sixth man to complete the career Grand Slam. Five-time major champion. One of the most memorable weekends we're ever going to have in golf. Incredible theater. It takes a lot for someone like me who watches all sports, who does this for a living, to feel sick to my stomach, completely rattled by nerves, and can't imagine what the guy on the course was feeling. The roller coaster ride that was this event, it was incredible. I think that there's going to be a lot of people that take a little while to come down from the high of this, including probably our next guest, Jason Sobel, golf analyst for SiriusXM, PGA Tour, and CBS. What's up, buddy?
Good morning, guys. Yeah, you're right about that. I'm still trying to catch my breath from yesterday, which was a wild, exhausting day. I can only imagine how exhausted Rory McIlroy is. Like, the rest of us are exhausted from watching him.
So let me just ask you this then. How many times did you think it was over? And that's both ways, like that he was done or that he had won. I counted it like eight.
The honest answer to this is, yes, it's either eight or, for me, really, the honest answer is zero. Like, even when he made that three-footer in the playoff and he's on his knees bawling on the final green, I'm like, yeah, are we sure that's over? Like, something's going to happen. Like, you know, he forgot to sign his scorecard or something's going to happen. That, like, I don't really believe this is ever over, but. So I was kind of the other way on it. Like, I just thought this thing's going to continue forever.
Yeah, well, it was crazy, too. It's like, that's not even including all the other stuff from the other days, right? Like, I had mentioned I had a friend on Friday who's a huge Rory fan going, hey, I'm sorry that I texted you. I can't believe Rory's actually having a great start to this major because he's 4-under on Thursday. And then he, you know, finishes, what was 15 and 17, where he just buckles under the pressure. He ends up even. Then Friday he goes out and shoots the low. And you're like, oh, my God, is he actually back? Is this really going to happen? okay, Rory, do the damn thing. Saturday is a bit of a roller coaster as well, but he finishes there, and everybody that I know is going, he's going to choke. He is not going to be able to do this. And the first hole starts with the double bogey. And I think that if you polled just golf fans, that what, 90% of them would have said that he's done, that it's completely over? Yeah. So, yeah, the roller coaster nature of this, Jason, how does that change the perception for you moving forward? Just the fact that this guy obviously had the demons, acknowledged the demons, but was battling them throughout the entire weekend and then did eventually find the way to overcome them.
Okay, so a lot to get here. First of all, I want to mention that no player had won the Masters with more than one double bogey since Craig Stadler back in 1982. That's 43 years ago. And Rory McIlroy had four double bogeys in this tournament. No player had ever won with two double bogeys in the final round. Rory McIlroy did that. When I spoke with him, I did a one-on-one with him for Masters Radio after the third round. And I asked him what it would take to get it done tomorrow. And he said, well, I've just got to be patient. All I'm thinking about is that first tee shot, put it in the fairway, and we'll go from there. I'm like, wow, great strategy, great mindset, taking it shot by shot. Okay, we're going to get this thing done. First ball in the bunker, hits it short of the green, hits the next one, a wedge shot, past the hole, tries to jam the putt in there, hits that one past, and then misses the next one for good measure. It's a double bogey, like you mentioned, and we're unraveling right from the start. For those who maybe don't watch golf on a regular basis, for those who maybe don't watch Rory McIlroy all that often, yesterday was the perfect microcosm for his entire career. This was the epitome of Rory McIlroy, which is can't stand being in front. Like he's got the lead, he's got every advantage, and all of a sudden he kicks it away. As soon as he kicks it away, well, now his back's against the wall, and now he starts fighting his way out of it. Now he gets into a bigger lead than he had originally, and can't stand prosperity once again. Hits a wedge into the water on 13. Now all of a sudden, okay, looks like it's tied. Hits a great shot on 50. I mean, it just went back and forth, and as soon as he tried to grab it, he'd let this thing go away. As soon as he let it go away, go grab it again. If nothing else, it made for really compelling theater.
So I have a theory on this, though, too, and I wonder how you feel about it, which is that the choking that he had throughout this tournament, like the 15 and 17 on day one, the holes that he played after the brilliant first six on Saturday, right, where it's just a birdie machine, you're going, okay, he's in complete cruise control, then he stumbles again. And I know nobody has, like, perfect tournaments. Everybody ends up facing adversity. But that, yeah, and the double bogey on one, that all of the adversity that he had faced already in the tournament allowed him to overcome it at other stages and, like, kept allowing him to recover. That he was, like, he had the line about not letting the two holes define his tournament, that in some way actually worked out for him, where it wasn't just, like, one collapse and then he fell apart. He had multiple, and so he kept going, okay, it's fine. We've done this already. We'll persevere.
It's not a bad theory, and I don't think you're wrong about that. In fact, I spoke with Bryson DeChambeau after the first round. He made a couple of early bogeys, and he said, I kind of like when I do that. And I looked at him weird, and he said, you know, I'm not trying to make bogeys, but when I do it, it sort of frees me up, and now I can go out there and like, okay, I don't have to be perfect. And I do think there's something to the fact that Rory McIlroy is trying to be perfect and then makes a mistake, and it's like, okay, well, perfection's over. It's just like a pitcher giving up a home run to the leadoff batter and saying, okay, well, look, you know, the no-hitter's over, the shutout's over. Let's just go pitch and try to win this thing. And that's what Rory McIlroy did. I think a lot of the credit should go to his work with Bob Rotella, the famous mental guru who's worked with so many golfers in the past. He mentioned Bob Rotella's name at least a dozen times in interview settings throughout the week, and he was working very closely with him. And like I said, I think that really helped him stay in the right frame of mind when everything was unraveling.
So, again, it was this incredible roller coaster ride, but I'm curious, what was the most shocking moment for you?
It was probably the wedge that he spun back in the water on 13, and not that it was just a bad wedge shot. Look, everybody hits a bad wedge shot once in a while, and things happen. It was that he played it conservatively off the tee, and as he's playing the hole, I'm arguing with some colleagues who said, Rory McIlroy is the greatest driver of his generation, or maybe any generation. How do you not hit driver on the par five? And I said, well, if he hooks driver into the trees, all of a sudden it's like, why are you hitting driver there? You've got a big lead. Just get it in the fairway. So I didn't have a problem with it. He played conservative, knocked it in the fairway. Played conservative, hit a layup shot short of Rays Creek. Then all of a sudden, somehow it got in his mind, you know what? Screw conservative. Let's go aggressive. We're going to spin a wedge to 2 feet and make birdie here. And instead, he spun it off the front of the green, made a seven, and the wheels are coming off right in front of us. You're like, you either play conservatively or you don't. He played conservatively, and then in the middle of playing conservatively, it was eating him from the inside. He's like, I can't do this anymore. I'm just going to go right at it. And that's what surprised me the most. But he was able to fight through that adversity. And maybe it was he might not have hit the shot on 15 if he hadn't hit one in the water on 13 first.
Yeah. Even as you're describing it, all I can think of is why it meant so much to so many people is because it meant so much to him. Right. It's yes. You could see it. And that is what makes this translate. And honestly, I think that this has been a problem with professional golf recently, especially with all the LIV Tour stuff, is guys leaving the tour to go play LIV, even though some of them, like Rom, left after we had already kind of conclusively found out that it wasn't really working and had grabbed the bag. And you wondered how much certain guys cared about things like legacy, right? And what the game means to them outside of, the pursuit of millions and millions of dollars. And so to have this moment with Rory, is there something from this that you think means more to just golf right now than that aspect of it? It's like just having a human champion who really lived in this moment and felt that moment.
I don't know that I want to read so much into it that this is the victory that saved golf, and this is going to bring everyone together, and this is going to make us love the game once again. All of that said, if we needed a reinforcement for why the players who went to LIV and are playing just for money, don't quite get it, don't quite understand a lot of the things, playing for legacy is everything. And now look, John Rahm could have won this weekend. He made the cut on the number and had a really good weekend. And if he goes out and wins, it's not like it means any less to a guy just because he plays LIV golf. But Rory has talked so much about legacy over the last 3 years, about playing the game for something bigger than yourself, something bigger than a paycheck, something bigger than you even realize. And so you could tell. I mean, that was, he said afterwards, all relief that was pouring out of him, not just joy on that final green when he finally won. And I can tell you, as a member of the media and a guy that speaks with Rory McIlroy on a fairly regular basis, I sure didn't want to spend the next year asking him questions about what happened at the Masters and do you ever think you're going to win one of these? And I know that Rory McIlroy didn't feel like spending the next year answering those questions. So I guess we both got what we wished for.
I was going to say, I don't know how many of those answers you would have got from him. I know he's very open with you guys, but oof, yeah, I think maybe just withholds from some of those questions for a while. He needs a bit of a break. So that's what I think is also compelling about this is, now, because probably so many people end up tuning in, and it is Rory McIlroy, right? He exists in a different echelon of celebrity in this sport than even the other players that he is compared with that are on tour right now, or even some of the LIV guys, is that, there's, I think, going to be more engagement from even just the casual viewer and even the hardcore viewer in terms of what he's going to do now. And so you could tell it obviously weighed on him, as he played and as he spoke about it. But do you think we see a freer and more determined Rory moving forward? What do the next few majors look like to you when it comes to Rory McIlroy's play?
I mean, things are just going to go easier from here on in. Look, this is like pushing a boulder up a mountain, and you've gotten to the top, and now we're on the other side. And it doesn't mean that he's going to win every single time he tees it up, but boy, there is a massive weight lifted from his shoulders when we get to Quail Hollow next month, which is already going to be a place that Rory McIlroy absolutely loves. He's won there 4 times for the regular PGA Tour event that's played there. I just think, yes, he's just going to be out there playing free, playing with house money a little bit. He's done what he wanted to do. And I know it's a weird dynamic for those who maybe don't pay attention to golf all that much, but, 5 major championships that some people might say, well, Tiger's got 15. Why is he not buckling down and trying to chase Tiger? In some respects he is, and Rory's going to want to win as many major championships as he can, but getting the Masters, especially that being the last leg of the career Grand Slam, just the sixth player to claim the career Grand Slam. I feel like everything from here on out is gravy for Rory McIlroy. And quite honestly, it, again, doesn't mean he's going to give up, doesn't mean he's going to stop working. In fact, it might mean the opposite. But I do think that if Rory McIlroy's career ends the way it just ended yesterday, that he'd be pretty satisfied with everything.
Yeah, as he should be. And, yeah, five is an incredible number, and obviously the career Grand Slam has only been now done. Like, he's in a very, 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 very select list of players. But I am curious how much you think he can actually alter his legacy moving forward here. Like, because you mentioned he'd be very happy. But if he's able to stack a few more major wins onto this career, like, he's only 35 years old. That was sort of the realization coming out of this. Even, I'll admit, even as I was watching him on 18 and he's in the playoff with Rose, I couldn't help myself from thinking, well, I was actually two different things. One was that he was competing with Bryson and that they feel like they're from different eras, and yet he's only, what, 4 years older than Bryson? I think that's right.
Yep.
And then it's like watching Rose, where a guy who's been a runner-up at this tournament twice before, who's 44 years old, and going, all right, as much as this would be brutal for Rory, I can't say I don't think he's ever going to win when this is the, like, this is the age bracket he's in. But now I'm looking at it and saying, all right, like, five is crazy, and this is obviously the impressiveness of the career Grand Slam. But yeah, once you start to get into, like, the 7-8 territory, yeah, I do think that this is, like, There's a lot more room for him to go legacy-wise.
There is, and yet, if you're not going to be one of the best of the best, I mean, we talk about Jack versus Tiger and who is the GOAT and who's the greatest of all time. And, you know, you can certainly have your opinion on it. I consider Jack the greatest. He has the most majors. Tiger was the most dominant. Tiger was the most whatever you want to call it, because Tiger was probably the best player, but he wasn't the greatest, because we measure greatness on major championships. And Rory can move up that loop. Now, again, unless you're sitting there with a full ranking of, okay, here's the top 10 in golf history. Rory's currently at number 14. And if he does this, he's going to move inside the top 10. I don't know that it necessarily changes the legacy. I remember I had a PGA Tour player tell me this a few years ago. He said, if you don't have a PGA Tour win and you get one, That solidifies your legacy. I mean, forever, you get introduced to someone, they say, this guy has a tour.
Yeah.
If you go from one to two, that does something for you as well. That means, like, hey, I wasn't a one-hit wonder. I won twice out there. That's a big deal. You go from two to three, okay. He goes, and this player had won three times. He says, if you go from three to four, nobody really cares.
Yeah.
Half the people are going to forget that you won three or four. It was just, he won a few times on the PGA Tour. I tend to think, I mean, in a much grander scale, that the same thing is at play for Rory McIlroy. Whether he finishes his career with nine majors or seven majors, the legacy is pretty much intact either way. The legacy is he's part of the career Grand Slam club, a very exclusive club. He's maybe the best European golfer of all time. He's the best of his generation, and he's a Hall of Famer, no doubt about it, Locke. All of that said, I mean, sure, he'd rather have four more majors than two more majors. But again, I just don't know that it changes the way we view him in the long run 20, 30 years from now.
Okay, so he joked about it, and I felt this during the moment where I was like almost, I wasn't torn because I really was rooting for him to win, but there was a small part of me going, man, we lose Rory's chase for the career Grand Slam. It's like, what's the next story, right? Like, what's the big thing that we do care about? And you're in it. What do you think is the most compelling story in golf moving forward?
Well, I'm going to stay with that storyline because I just wrote a story. It'll be up later today for BetMGM on who the next player will be to break into the career Grand Slam club. And it's such an interesting conversation to me because we've had two in the last 58 years. That was Tiger Woods and Rory McIlroy. And so we don't expect it to happen next month. And yet, literally, it could happen next month. Jordan Spieth could be the next player to capture the career Grand Slam if he wins the PGA Championship. Now, he just finished 14th at the Masters. He hasn't won on the PGA Tour in 3 years. He's only won twice this decade. I don't know that there's a great chance of Jordan winning, but it's such a fascinating conversation because, quite frankly, the answer to this question could be, oh, it happens in May next month, or, oh, it won't happen for 50 years. Like, the person who's going to be the next career Grand Slam holder is 25 years away from being born. which is unfathomable to even like try to consider. But it's like it's not a name that we can even mention. Like the, like his parents haven't met each other yet. You know, one of those kind of things. So it could be Jordan Spieth. It could be Xander Schauffele by next April. I mean, it could be one of these players that we've come to know right now, and it could be someone that, you know, is long far in the distance that we don't even know about yet.
I'll say this, though. It wouldn't be good for Jordan to do it this year simply because it would be so overshadowed by Rory that people would be like, I guess. Congrats.
I do think it takes a little luster, yes, takes something away from Jordan. It also takes some luster away from what Rory did. I mean, we're sitting here saying this is one of the greatest accomplishments we'll ever see in golf in our lifetimes. And a month later, we're like, oh, and here it is again.
Yeah.
I know it was tainted for other reasons, but it's sort of like McGuire and Sosa both going after the home run record at the same time. You're like, wait, it can't be that hard if two guys are doing it at the exact same time.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's a great point, honestly. It's like if you were brand new to golf, you'd be like, wait, so just everybody's out here chasing these Grand Slams? I thought this was special. You're like, it is. Right. It is special, all right? Trust me. You just got to believe in me. Okay, but so I agree that the Spieth in terms of the PGA, that'll be a story now moving forward in a completely different way. Just people will care. Like, you're still going to want to see it. I don't think that it'll be as big this year, but moving forward, it'll definitely be a compelling story. But when it comes to Augusta specifically, next year, if you're doing, and I almost hate this because it does feel like you can't just live in the moment. You always got to look to the next thing. But that's who I am. I'm a millennial. Uh-huh. That's what happens here. What is going to be your biggest point of curiosity there? Because I have one.
Oh, I'm interested to see where you're going. Can Bryson return?
Yeah, that's
sort of figured out Augusta. Okay. I also think I'll throw in there that, and it kind of going to get overshadowed by Rory and Rose and everything like that. With two holes to play in the Masters yesterday, Ludvig Åberg in his second Masters, after finishing runner-up in his first, was tied for the lead. Now, he made a triple bogey. He made a terrible triple bogey on the last hole. I think he was trying to do something on 18 out of the bunker that he probably shouldn't have tried. But it's like, hey, I basically have to make this or get it really close to have a chance to win the Masters. And he tried it and wound up tumbling down to like 6th or 7th on the leaderboard. All that said, Ludvig Åberg is a generational talent in his own right. This guy is made in a lab to go win at Augusta National, and it would not surprise me whatsoever to see him in a green jacket by next year.
Yeah, so I think that there was, if people are being honest with themselves who watch this, that Åberg for a long stretch of this tournament actually felt like the most relevant guy outside of Rory because Bryson basically disappeared right after the fifth hole. I was like, oh, okay. Yeah. I didn't feel like Bryson was putting any of the pressure on. And when you saw him just like misread some of these putts and just power him through the break, you went, okay, man, this guy, he just does not have it today. Åberg, I think, is definitely the guy to watch moving forward in terms of golf's next big star, the guy that can sort of enter that group of players that whenever they're on a leaderboard, you're just going to care a little bit more. But for me, it's Bryson simply because of what we just went through with Rory, which is the human element of all this. Like Rory, he was clearly perturbed when he made the comment about Rory not talking to him, which I was like, why are you even mentioning this? Like, of course he wasn't going to talk to you. Like, why would he talk to you? This is strange, but you saw him get off and he was like, people love the honesty of Rory. They should love the honesty of Bryson. He wore it. He spoke on it like very, very clearly, very honestly. He was a sweaty mess. He looked completely disheveled after the round. Like it took a toll from him. And this is someone who has had a lot of hype, was supposed to be a breaker of worlds when it comes to this tournament. And I kind of feel like he was right there. He had it. If he just has like a decent day, he could be Masters champion in a way, like a Masters champion of him going head to head with Rory McIlroy with the most stakes, right? Making this thing extremely memorable. So for me, I actually am very curious to see how he responds next year at this tournament. And it's kind of like him far and away above everybody else, at least in this moment right now.
Bryson has gone from the most polarizing figure in the game of golf to one of the more likable figures.
Yeah.
It's a transformation that I don't really think we've seen in anybody else in the game, at least not in a recent memory. That said, it's very funny to me because some of the live players, and we can point to who they are, essentially took the money, took the bag, went to live. And look, maybe they just haven't found their games in the majors yet, but there's been a definite decline in their level of play since they've gone over to the other two, or whether it's I'm only used to playing three round events, or I'm not playing enough golf. They've only played five events so far this season. Whatever the reason is, they just don't seem like they're bringing their best stuff to the majors. Other guys, and Bryson is at the top of this list, seem like they're more prepared and more motivated for the major championships. Like, okay, this is my chance to shine. People are actually watching for these 4 days. I got to put on a show for them. And I love what Bryson's been able to do. Look, the YouTube stuff is fine. I'm not that into all the content creation and hitting the ball over my house and trying to make a hole in one and all that kind of stuff. But look, if people like it, then I'm into it. It brings people into the game of golf, and he's become a beloved figure in the game of golf. He's got people rooting for him. I walked around for a while yesterday, and I think it was more of a partisan Rory crowd, but it wasn't like people were booing Bryson. Granted, some of that has to do with Augusta National and the patrons there knowing their golf and having a little more of a polite manner than if it was a U.S. Open or PGA. But that said, people are yelling, go Bryson, just as much, and people are rooting for him. And so, yeah, look, I think he's certainly shown himself worthy of picking him for major championships, the guy that isn't going to back down from any of the best players on the PGA Tour whatsoever.
So, yeah, I shouldn't say shocked at how popular he was, because obviously I've seen this already start to happen, but I think it's like three things. One, he just switched to a normal hat. People are sick of the old hat. Two is that the Brooks Koepka feud went from "haha, this is funny" to Koepka becoming almost bullish. It got to a point where people were like, "Ew, what you're doing is the weird stuff." Now we thought this was funny, and now you kind of seem like the jerk in all of this. And three is just he fist bumps people. He goes to the gallery and he'll just stick his hands out and fist bump everybody, and like he's actually just giving you something. And now it's like it's completed this massive heel turn into he's a total face.
You're right about all that, and I'm going to give you one more. Yeah. He used to come to interview sessions, press conferences with the media, and try to sound like the smartest guy in the room. And maybe try to sound smarter than he actually was. Yeah. I remember him using the word proprioception in relation to something he was doing with his game. And the writers looked at him like, huh? And he goes, oh, guys, let me tell you about proprioception. And like, come on, man. Like, just
shut
act
up
like a normal human and try to sound like you're smarter than everybody else. We all know you were a C student at SMU, which is perfectly fine, not a big deal, but don't try to act like you're a scientist. And for the first 5 years of his career, that's what he was doing. I've come to really like Bryson. I tell people all the time, people say, Bryson's kind of a weird dude. I go, you know what? Every single time I've ever asked him for an interview, not only does he comply, but he put some thought and some effort into the interview. I mean, a lot of guys kind of just spit out some word salad and cliches and go through the motions and walk away. But Bryson actually gives you something when you talk to him. So I really like Bryson. I hope he comes back and keeps playing well in the major championships. Look, we can talk all we want about the game being fractured right now and the PGA Tour and LIV guys needing to get together and whether it will ever happen. But I will say this much. If we're looking for a silver lining, I think the major championships over the last 3 years have become even more compelling because we only see these guys playing against each other four times a year now.
Yep. No, I think that's a great point. And this one was unbelievable. Jason, I really do appreciate you coming on. I know it's a super busy day. You got a ton of work ahead of you. So thank you so much for making time and coming on.
You got it. Thanks for having me.
Take care, man. Jason Sobel. You can read his piece up on BetMGM today. I don't know. I came away from this both furious with Bryson for robbing us of a moment, where I was like, man, you couldn't just be around it. You couldn't just be threatening. You couldn't just be looming. Like when Rory puts it in the creek on 13, you're not even like it didn't matter with you. That sucked. But also caring a little bit more about him and going, huh, okay, let's see what happens next time around. I think you always care about the certain big names that are at the major tournaments. And that's I think to Jason's point about the LIV guys, when they show up, I don't feel the tension between them and the guys on tour anymore. I think that's gone. That's dead. That's buried. There's just none of it. It's like, yeah, sure. Patrick Reed. If Phil was able to do something, maybe you'd feel that kind of like heelishness of a golfer, but it's just not really there with anybody. It's just not, there's no guy that you love to hate who's great. And certainly not any of the guys from LIV now where it feels like, oh, they're the They're the threat to golf. It's not. It's done. That's all over. That's all done with. But yeah, I definitely came away from this more interested in Bryson DeChambeau moving forward. He was a huge loser at this tournament, given what he did on the final day, but he was a winner in terms of what I think his popularity is going to be moving forward. Either way, there's like a great joy in having watched that, but also a tiny bit of sadness in just knowing that it's going to be a long time before I think we ever have a golf tournament that's nearly, like, even close to that compelling. I just, yeah, like Jason mentioned it, it might be someone who isn't born yet before we get another Masters or another major that's quite like what we just saw. So it was special. I think that everybody was able, well, most people, I think even if you don't care about golf at all, like, you know me, I'm not Mr. Golf. I don't love golf. But even if you're just a sports fan, I think that you could understand that and care about that. You could be like the most fringy casual. And I had even some like family members and friends who were like that who reached out to me. So yeah, anyways, it was brilliant. Let's take a quick break. Again, the Vladimir Guerrero Jr. press conference is later today at 1 p.m. There's an extended episode of Blair and Barker. They will be taking it at 1 o'clock. It's on Sportsnet, Sportsnet Plus, Sportsnet 59 The Fan, everywhere Sportsnet. Okay, you got Sportsnet stuff? Cool. You can listen or watch Vladdy. Subscribe to this podcast. If you're a listener, if you're on radio, you're new, whatever, it really helps me out. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at JD Bunkus. I always appreciate feedback. Quick break, and then we'll hit what we missed, including a massive breakout for the UFC, a huge win weekend for them too. I'm going to get into this a little bit more tomorrow with Arden Zwelling because he is a Blue Jays sideline reporter who does one of the biggest Blue Jays pods in the country, but also he's trying to get in the waters with the UFC here. The Sportsnet signed the UFC deal, and my man is writing pieces. It's good articles, so he's got a sharp eye for it. But before we do what we missed, I just got to spend a couple minutes here talking about the UFC 314 on Saturday night, which, man, it was a really fun one. Really fun card. God, it was a good one. Alex Volkanovski is back. He wins his belt. He gets redemption against a just big old freak in Diego Lopez who just hits hard. Like, I thought that Diego Lopez was like completely outclassed in that fight from a like strategic ability standpoint. You could just see the pedigree of Volkanovski. But the size of him and whenever he would land was heavy. And you saw it in Volk's face. He lost his eyesight at one point in the fight. He got knocked down, but he was the better fighter through five rounds. And Diego Lopez, though, man, just kind of kept coming forward. Seemed like he was a little rattled early, but then once the fight started going, he was doing the thing where he's trying to challenge Volk to come at him because he wanted the counterpunch as the bigger guy. But yeah, credit to Volk, who looked great. I will say, watching it and just the damage that he took and knowing that he has had those last two fights ending in knockouts, I don't know how long of a runway this is going to be, but he was awesome. In his post-game, he's talking to Joe Rogan about how adversity is a privilege, and I thought that that resonated probably with a lot of people. I thought that was a great message for him to send. But yeah, I don't think that this is going to be a long runway for Volk, even when you saw Diego Lopez touch him up and the knockdowns. The fear that was there is different than the Volk of old. That was the difference between the Volk of old, because everyone was rushing to this idea like, oh, he's back. And I went, yeah, amazing win. Incredible accomplishment. He is genuinely one of, yeah, he's like an all-timer. He's a UFC Hall of Famer. There's no doubt about it. But I'm not sure how long this runway is going to be, and that's kind of obvious given that I think he's like 36 years old, 35 years old, somewhere around that, somewhere in that range. Felt kind of the same thing with Michael Chandler watching him, if I'm being dead honest. Great for Paddy Pimblett, but Michael Chandler, I believe, is now 39 years old, and as jacked as he is and as incredible shape as he is in, there is just the reality of the situation when it comes to fighting in that weight class at that age. He's not a heavyweight, and he got body bagged by Paddy Pimblett. And I'll say this, going into this fight, I was a little surprised that Paddy was a pretty heavy favorite. And I thought that there was value on Michael Chandler because he's a guy who's had many of these five round fights. Paddy always has the stuff with the diet that is almost as famous as his personality, which is this guy in between fights just decides to go eat. There's this incredible clip that it was a Barstool radio interview where he's just talking. It's him and Meatball Molly. And he's just breathing heavily into the microphone. And she's like, hey, we can hear you breathing. And he's like, oh, lad, I'm eating all the food, lad. And he's just, he's fat. Like, he's so fat for, between fights. And he details his diet in Chicago. He's like, I had the deep dish, lad. I had the hot dogs, lad. And it's just like, he's going, talking about all the food he ate in a single day. And you're like, my God, dude. And so I kind of wanted to see it at this level against Michael freaking Chandler. It's a big step up in competition from what he's faced. And he dominated him. Chandler took him down early. And I thought, ooh, see, like the wrestling Patty, he is still a British guy is what I think. I texted my brother. Obviously, the American wrestlers have been better than the British wrestlers. And then he found ways to get up. And then he just whooped his ass. He was bigger. And you saw just like how big he is, right? Like Chandler's a shorter fighter, but he usually feels big at that weight class in terms of like the body mass of him. And Patty just picked him apart and started tossing him around and bloodied him up, cut him up, made him messy. And the message to the UFC was, I'm not sure what the ceiling is of this guy as an all-time champion. Straight up. I just still don't know it with Patty Pimblett. He said, what now? What now? What now, lad? That's just the, what now, lad? I'll do it more Scottish there. But you get the drift. You get the idea. He has star power with him, man. What now was, well, we got to see you go up the level. We got to see you fight the Charles Oliveiras of the world. We got to see, like, there is levels to this game, and Michael Chandler is one tier, and he has had some great fights, but he loses those fights, right? So, as impressive as a win as that was, nothing taken away from him whatsoever. You can only fight who's in front of you, and he took care of him. He obliterated him. But there still are questions in terms of what his ceiling is, I think, as a fighter. I don't think it's a complete unknown where you're saying, oh, this guy is definitely going to be a champion someday. This guy is a bona fide, no doubt about it. It's just a matter of when he will be champion and for how long. Those are still up in the air to me. But he is a star, lad. He is a star. The way the arena reacted to him. And we've known this, that he's got a following, right? Patty, oh, Patty the Body. That's fun. That's fun stuff. That's fun stuff. But I had Ariel on here, what, about a month ago? And I asked him, yeah, who are the stars? Where are the stars at? Because it doesn't really feel like we've got a lot of stars in the UFC right now. It just doesn't. Like, point them out. Point to me the stars that you just absolutely need to see. Yeah. Champions? Do you need to see Islam Makhachev? Like, do you need to see him? You need to. You need to see him. I don't know. I don't think you need to see him. Go through the pound-for-pound rankings and show me all the guys that you need to see. They've had some bad beats with Poatan, with Sean O'Malley, and now they've got a guy who's, like, on the rise, who's got a real fan base behind him. The arena goes nutso. He speaks incredibly fun. He sounds fun. He's fun. He's just entertaining. And he fought in a super entertaining fashion. He bloodied a guy up. And that's not for everybody. For those of us that love the sport, though, it's like, boy, he beat the brakes off Michael Chandler. He made him ugly. Michael Chandler definitely thinking about his future after that fight. And that's kind of what you want from a young upstart. And so the Patty the Batty thing has now become probably one of the most important things to the UFC. And I thought you saw that on Saturday night. So huge star breakout for them. There's a difference when guys win those fights. And he broke through in a different way. He was already popular. I get it. He's a different thing now. Anyways, Armin, Brandon, what did we miss?
JD. I was going to ask you a follow-up on Patty, but...
Sure, what do you want?
I was just going to say, if he has enough juice out of the ring to, like, really be that next star in terms of his trash talking and everything, is it good enough?
Yes.
Yeah, it's like elite?
Buddy, that wasn't the question with him. That was not the problem with Patty the Batty. The problem was is that, like I said, between fights... He goes and eats the world, and he's young, so he's able to recover from those things. But when you're fighting at this level in 2025, like, we're not in the 90s anymore, bro. You're in the age of you got to do just about everything right, unless you're one of the one-of-one freaks. And I don't know if he's a one-of-one freak from a talent standpoint. Like, even some of the – like, he was big in there, and when he was landing, it was crazy. And he fought, like, a courageous step-forward fight against Michael Chandler, but – yeah, his boxing's not like, whoa, his wrestling isn't, whoa. He's got good submission game. He's got good jujitsu. There's no doubt about that. It's really good. But he has nothing about him is like an 11 out of 10 special talent outside of maybe his size in that weight class, which is like imposing. But no, the off, out of the octagon stuff with him is, that's why you knew who he was from the outset. He's great at talking trash. He's like, he's got that factor. No doubt about it. That factor is not up for debate. That's there. He's got it. The branding, the trash talking, all, yeah. That's already done. We already know that part. What's okay. next?
You touched on this with Ennis quickly, but you guys didn't expand. I'm kind of curious. Does it not feel after Jeff Hoffman blew the kiss to the Orioles dugout yesterday, does it not feel like the Orioles could be sneakily like our biggest rival for this season? I'm not talking historically, anything, just right now.
Yeah, no, I like this take. That's how I feel. I'm with you. I'll always hate the Yankees. I'll always hate the Red Sox. But here's the truth. They don't think about us. We're nothing to them. They're what Canucks are to the Leaf fans. Just irrelevant. Sure, I guess it's a rivalry when we play each other. Canada, big cities, sure. We don't care. Nobody cares. We don't. Sorry, Vancouver. We're just not taking part in it. We just don't care. We don't care. We are not paying attention to what you do.
Gerrit Cole's not there either this season.
No, but it's not even about that. It's that we're always, there's nothing the Blue Jays can do to ever get in on the Red Sox-Yankees rivalry. Just like there's nothing Vancouver can do to get in on Toronto-Boston, Toronto-Montreal, Toronto-Ottawa. Like, we got other fish to fry here. You're not a part of it. So, yeah, you're a part of Canada, but you're not a part of this. Just like the Jays are a part of the AL East, but they're not that. But the Jays and the Orioles are in that class right now where it's like, hey.
Let's start our own.
Yeah, but we've had 2016 against these guys. We had an awesome moment against the Orioles. What's the biggest moment that the Jays have had, like, against the Red Sox and Yankees? Like, the pennant chase? Like, division pennant in 2015?
Aaron Judge, so lovable.
Yeah, no it's like, I hate Aaron Judge. Yeah, but...
like Jazz Chisholm's easy to hate. That's the only guy I could think of.
No, really. They're all hateable. I hate every single Yankee. Bellinger, Judge, you put on the pinstripes, I hate your guts. It's fun to hate the Yankees. I hate the Yankees more than I hate the Orioles. Mm-hmm. But I think that there is more of, like, an actual rivalry right now between these two teams. They've got guys who are just bona fide Blue Jay killers. Like Ryan Mountcastle is not on the radar of a Red Sox fan. He's like, I don't know who that is. The seven hole guy. Great. Who gives a crap? Blue Jays fans know who he is. They hate him. Yeah. Now we've got the Hoffman thing that adds more drama to this. Hate their manager. He's had multiple incidents with the Toronto Blue Jays. They stole what Toronto was supposed to be, which is like the young upstart team with the enviable cavalcade of young stars. That you're worried about how many you're going to be able to pay. Like, that's them. They got all these dudes. Adley Rutschman, another absolute Blue Jay killer. So, no, I think there's something to these games. And it feels like the Orioles own the Jays in a way that all these other teams don't. And so when Toronto beats them and they find ways to overcome like they did in last night's game or last afternoon's game, yeah, it feels a little bit more meaningful to me right now. I like the Orioles. I like the series with the Orioles in terms of the games where there feels like juice. I got people going, hey, I hope Hoffman gets revenge tomorrow. The night before the Orioles game. Is there anybody that you're looking for revenge against with the Yankees? No, it's not there. It's not there. The Red Sox fans, the only thing that was annoying and pissing people off with them and the Yankees was the idea that they were going to steal Vladdy, but that's a Big Brother move. Big Brother steals the things from you, not the Orioles. That was never part of the discussion. This is just like baseball on baseball, best on best. You know, who's going to have the better punch? Which one of these two teams that is the lesser light from the optic standpoint in the American League East could win the American League East? So, yeah, I think it's one that I care about anyways. I think it's a budding rivalry. I like watching these two teams play. I don't think they like each other. And, yeah, Hoffman blowing the kiss only added to it. And I went, hell yeah, Jeff. I don't like to tweet too much. Like, you know, I get my moments. I pick my spots. But I was fired up watching that Blue Jays game. Like, I was pissed off about Nathan Lucas leaving the bag. I was pissed off watching, I almost called him Kendrick, Anthony Santander fall down in the outfield. I was fired up when Jeff Hoffman was shown in the dugout with his arm all wrapped up going, hell yeah, kid, get back out there and pump heaters. And he did that. So, yeah, awesome win for the Jays. And I don't think I would have felt that way, honest to God, against, like, I really wanted the Red Sox sweep, but there was something a little different with the Orioles where it was like, I wanted it for Hoffman. I wanted it for that team. I hate the Orioles. It's awesome.
Yeah, and so, JD, we saw the Winnipeg Jets yesterday clinch the President's Trophy for the first time in their history.
Yep. Everybody likes the Jets.
Yeah, right. And it's the first Canadian team to do that since 2012. The Canucks won the President's Trophy. And no team has won the Cup since winning that trophy in 2012. 2013 was the Blackhawks.
Yep.
So that being said, with a bit of time in between the last President's Trophy Cup winner, is there enough benefit or do you get any benefit from finishing first in the league? What do you think?
The thing is you don't get enough of a benefit, but there's no way to change that. Like, it just, the first round of the Stanley Cup playoffs has always been perfect. This has been my whole argument against why I hate the idea of a play-in. I hate the idea of adding more teams to a tournament that's already extremely hard to win. But there's just no solution because the first round is really perfect. That's why, again, I hate the playoff bracket. It's so stupid that, again, the Oilers are playing the Kings. Four straight years. Yay! Sucks! Let's just call it for what it is. It sucks. Nobody wants that. You think Kings fans want that? You know who wants it? Oilers fans, because they're like, yep, guaranteed win, as always. It's brutal. There's no rivalry between those teams. Nobody cares about that series. Nobody wants that series. And then you've got this Dallas-Colorado series. It's like way too early, far too early for this. But Gary Bettman, for whatever reason, just won't move off of it. He's like, I made this choice, and it's a great idea, even though everybody hates it. Everybody hates it. It is going to give us Battle of Ontario, so that part of it kind of does work out. So that's kind of nice. It seems like that's pretty well locked in at this point. But no, there's not enough advantage, but there isn't any solution. So them's the breaks of a league that is parity. And what I would say to the Winnipeg Jets fans, it sucks because your owner seems to be like, I mean, he brought back the team there and he spends money, even though a lot of you didn't go for a lot of portions of the season. This is what happens when you put in a hard cap and you want flat cap and parity, is that you end up having one seeds and eight seeds and everybody feels kind of equal. So them's the breaks of the world you've created. So I don't love it, but it is what it is. But congrats to the Jets. Everybody likes the Jets. It's just a fact. We'll see you tomorrow.